Good evening. It's time for the reading of the Arizona Daily Sun from Sun Sounds of Arizona in Flagstaff. I'm your reader, Bethany Williams, and I will be reading from the Tuesday, March 11th, 2025 edition of the Arizona Daily Sun. First, though, the weather. At 5 p.m. on the 11th, it is 47 degrees with winds from the southwest around 17 miles per hour, gusts up to 25, mostly cloudy skies. Relative humidity 33%. Earlier today, we had a high of 49, and we're expecting it to get as low as 26 before it starts to get warmer again on Wednesday. There's a 70% chance of rain or snow overnight. There's a 30% chance of precipitation on Wednesday morning. Wednesday will remain mostly cloudy with a high near 43 and southwest winds around 10 miles per hour, give or take. Wednesday night, it's supposed to be a low of 28 as it remains cloudy. And then Thursday, there's about a 90% chance of snow showers with accumulation expected. A high of 39 and a low of 15 going into Friday. And now, the headlines from the Arizona Daily Sun. Airport mulls parking costs. Council shies away from immigration issues. And wolf advocates say, job far from done. But the top story is winter storm delivers. Flagstaff receives 16 plus inches of snow from last week's storm with more in the forecast by Daily Sun staff. A photo shows Kimberly DeNoon with a unique Thulu themed hat. It's more like a, what's the word? The thing that goes over your whole face, but that sort of thing, while she clears snow. The Flagstaff area got some much-needed snow from the storm that hit the area last week, and another system appears to be in the forecast for this week as well. Balaclava, that's what it's called. Anyway, according to the National Weather Service in Belmont, Flagstaff received more than 16 inches of snow between Thursday and Friday, with the bulk falling on Friday, a record 15.9 inches for March 7th. That day was also a record for precipitation at 0.96 inches. Despite all the fresh powder, the region is still significantly underneath the average for this time of year. The storm nearly doubled the snow total so far this season, bringing Flagstaff to 31.8 inches, but the normal through March 10th is 74.3 inches. Precipitation is similarly behind, with a total of 2.89 inches since January 1st, lagging the average of 4.9. The forecast for this week calls for a quick heating system Tuesday night into Wednesday. Though little snow accumulation is expected, the National Weather Service has 3 to 7 inches of snow listed for Thursday, however, with a 90% chance of more showers that evening. The winter weather also hit other areas of northern Arizona hard, with some reports listing Williams with nearly 2 feet of snow and Doney Park getting 18 inches. Interstate 40 was closed in both directions because of the storm for several hours Friday night into Saturday morning, all the way from Ash Fork to Winslow. And that was Winter Storm Delivers. Flagstaff Pulliam Airport looking to add monthly rates and lost ticket fees. Rate increases also discussed by Cody Bashore. With nearly 800 parking spaces available between its two lots, and capacity regularly sitting under 50% outside of the holidays, Flagstaff Pulliam Airport may soon begin offering monthly parking rates. The possibility was discussed during the City of Flagstaff's Airport Commission meeting in early January, in addition to the potential for a lost ticket fee and an increase to all rates for July 2026. While the airport's paid parking system began in July of 2023, the rates were adopted by the Flagstaff City Council in December of 21, and the associated costs for the system have risen significantly in the years since, according to the airport's director, Brian Gall. Additionally, parking rates at other airports have increased in recent years since Flagstaff set its rates, based on a study conducted in 2021. Currently, the airport's daily rate for its terminal lot and those 380 spaces is $8, with a weekly rate of $48. Slightly further from the terminal, in the economy lot, constructed in 2022, with 413 spaces, rates are $6 per day and $36 per week. Gall told the commission that somewhere between two-thirds and three-quarters of the cars utilizing the paid parking system are currently in the terminal lot, which seemed to serve as an example that the higher-priced lot is not a deterrent for travelers at the current rate and its closer proximity to the terminal itself. The proposed increase to the rates could potentially balance the usage of the two lots, Gall added. Raising the lots by $2 and $1 respectively, the terminal lot would increase to a daily rate of $10 and the economy to $7. The weekly rate, offering one free day per week, would remain the same formula, and all the increased rates would be effective on July 1, 2026. These fees went to effect in 2023 and were set quite a bit earlier than that, so we're thinking it's time to look at a potential future increase, Gall said to the commission during the January 9th presentation, adding that wage increases for the workers in charge of the system and the cost of the third-party monitoring system have gone up in the time since the rates were set. Though some airports of similar size were noted as having slightly higher rates, such as Yuma's $10 daily charge, Durango, Colorado's $9 daily charge, and Montrose, Colorado's $11 daily charge, members of the commission were concerned about moving forward with sending proposed rate increases to the Flagstaff City Council before more data was gathered. Commissioner Andrew Schaus suggested looking for information regarding the parking rates charged by airports with similar enplanements, defined as revenue passengers boarding flights, as opposed to just similar current pricing within the region. Additionally, Commissioner Colby White suggested gathering an estimate of potential revenue with a $3 increase to the terminal lot while the economy lot's rates remained the same, based on the observed usage of the lots. My worry is about raising rates without seeing the justification behind the raise of those rates, Schaus said, adding he understands costs are constantly increasing in the economy, but that the public might not quite understand the increased costs associated with a predominantly automated parking system. While the commission ultimately voted 4-1 in favor of holding off on sending proposed increases to City Council, the addition of a monthly rate and a lost ticket fee were approved to move forward and join the existing rates. Explaining that members of the community had asked for a monthly rate, Gall said the airport's proposal of $160 for the terminal lot and $120 for the economy lot came by offering 2 days free per week across 4 weeks at the existing daily rate. With the airport looking to utilize its existing parking availability, Gall said even at Thanksgiving and Christmas, there were around 300 spaces open. We do have quite a surplus right now given our current flight availability, Gall said. One of the reasons we proposed a monthly rate and not a quarterly rate or yearly rate is because we want to have that flexibility to say, well, we're going to release, say, 100 parking permits out of our 300 spaces available. If we start to fill up with a new flight addition or additional routes or a new airline, we can pull those back on a month-to-month basis. Similarly, the addition of lost ticket fees aims to retain some lost revenue. Though the parking system reads the license plates when cars enter the lots, Gall said there are instances where the camera either misreads the plate or the plate is obscured. When a traveler returns to their car and has lost their ticket, there have been times where people have been let out without paying due to the system being unable to match when they initially entered the lot. Basing the rate off the average parking duration at the airport, Gall said the lost ticket rates of $72 for the terminal lot and $54 for the economy lot reflect a week and a half of parking. The proposed lost ticket fee would be significantly cheaper than the comparable airports currently instituting them, with St. George, Utah charging $150, Mesa Gateway $250, and Yuma $350. Not all airports charge lost ticket fees, Gall said. Some have full-time staff that really work hard to figure out what to charge people when they leave. Ours is a little bit more hands-off. We do most of ours through automation and third-party consultants. Should the proposal move to the city council, the monthly rate and lost ticket fees would be effective immediately upon adoption. That article was Airport Moles Parking Costs. Request for Flagstaff City Council to discuss immigration and deportation issues comes up short, by Sam McLaughlin. Following extensive public comment at the conclusion of last week's meeting, the Flagstaff City Council declined to place the topic of federal immigration enforcement and deportation efforts on a future agenda. Councilmember David Spence had submitted a future Agenda Item Request, FAIR, for a discussion regarding immigration and deportation issues in Flagstaff in light of the current federal deportation initiative. The support of three council members is required to approve an FAIR. Only Spence and Councilmember Anthony Garcia ultimately chose to support the request. In his explanation of the request, Spence said, "We live in turbulent times with regard to migration, both legal and extra-legal. There are federal statutes and an aggressive federal deportation initiative underway at this time to rid America of persons without legal status. There are also existing state statutes, as well as a bill pending the Arizona legislature, Senate Bill 1164, which has the nickname AZ ICE Act. That act, if approved, would require Arizona law enforcement agencies to comply with detainer requests issued by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. It would also prohibit the enactment of any policy at any level of government that, quote, prohibits or restricts cooperation with immigration enforcement agencies. The bill has passed the state Senate and is under consideration by the House. At least two other bills seeking to mandate greater state-level cooperation in federal immigration enforcement actions have been introduced in this legislative session, House Bill 2099 and Senate Bill 1111. The latter seeks to establish a deportations fund, giving local law enforcement agencies a $2,500 bounty for each undocumented immigrant they assist in deporting. Governor Katie Hobbs has already stated she will veto that bill if it reaches her desk. Also pending is the legal viability of Arizona's Proposition 314, which would designate crossing the U.S.-Mexico border outside of a port of entry as a state crime, in addition to a federal one. Proposition 314 was approved by voters in the November 2024 general election. But that provision cannot take effect unless a federal court rules in favor of a similar law in Texas. I'm proposing we have a council discussion on how federal and state actions in this arena will affect Flagstaff and our residents, Spence said. With a nod to the city attorney, he specified he was not suggesting Flagstaff should violate any federal or state law. Spence's FAIR drew an atypical number of public comments. 3 people spoke against the proposed agenda item, 10 spoke in favor of it. Among the commenters opposed was Phil Goldblatt, who asked City Council, "Why are you worried?" Goldblatt stated that undocumented immigrants are some of the worst criminals from other countries. Substantial social research has demonstrated that immigrants, including undocumented immigrants, actually commit crimes at a lower rate than the U.S.-born population. Another commenter, B.J. Dempsey, alleged that any discussion of the subject would inevitably be aimed at skirting the laws, in his words, and might threaten the city's federal or state grant funding agreements. Those who spoke in favor of a future city council discussion argued the issue was too consequential for city leaders to avoid. "Better to bring this out in the open than try to hide this," commenter Jill Stevenson said. "We need to talk about it." Amy Martin, another commenter who supported the FAIR, brought large prints of photographs she has taken of undocumented immigrants holding objects that symbolize their contributions to the community. "This is so hard that we have to have this discussion without the people that this is directly affecting," Martin said. Other commenters read personal narratives they said were written by undocumented residents of Flagstaff. Those stories emphasized immigrants' aspirations, achievements, fears, and fears of deportation. "They deserve to stay here, and to demonize them is really unconscionable," Joe Bader said after reading one such story. After the public comment period, Mayor Becky Daggett asked the council for a show of hands to indicate support for moving the FAIR forward. Only Spence and Garcia raised their hands. The members of the council who did not support the FAIR used the subsequent to/from portion of the meeting, normally reserved for informational items only, to explain their reasoning. Councilmember Lori Matthews said she was not in favor of the FAIR because the topic was, quote, "emotionally charged," and "it's something we cannot legally do anything about." Councilmember Austin Aslan said, "I'm very concerned about the state of affairs that prompted this FAIR and concerned for those in our Flagstaff neighborhoods who are affected." But he added, "We can be loud or we can be effective." He did not elaborate upon what actions he considers effective. Vice Mayor Miranda Sweet spoke briefly, saying only, "I believe that this conversation can happen and should happen in this community, and I believe it is happening. I'm supportive of the discussion among our community members." Councilmember Kara House, who was attending the day's meeting remotely, thanked Spence for his request and acknowledged real fear and concern among community members. However, she said, "I fear that bringing heightened attention to some of these issues in a public forum could unintentionally place the very people we're seeking to support at greater risk." She was in conversation, she said, with groups that are deeply engaged with impacted individuals and would continue those conversations. Daggett also acknowledged the fear in the community. "People are scared," she said. But similar to Aslan's remarks, she stated, "There are more effective ways to address the issue, and those are underway." She did not specify what those were. Daggett encouraged members of the public concerned about immigration or deportation to reach out to their representatives on the City Council via email. That article was, "Council Shies Away from Talking Immigration Issues." Finally, on the front page, we have this from Sam McLaughlin of the Sun staff. "Wolf advocates say job far from done." The number of endangered Mexican gray wolves living in the wild across Arizona and New Mexico has reached at least 286. Officials with the two states' game and fish departments announced, with 2024 being the 9th consecutive year of population growth. The latest minimum count is based on a multi-method survey conducted between November of 2024 and this last February. The survey relies on remote cameras, scat collection, and visual observations, and is conducted annually each winter. Once again, the data collected on the recovering Mexican wolf population show progress, said Stuart Lilly, chief of the wildlife for the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish, in a press release. Mexican gray wolves were hunted to the brink of extinction in the mid-20th century and were reintroduced to the wild in 1998 after a program of captive breeding. Their recovery is overseen by an interagency coalition, which includes the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Arizona and New Mexico Mountain Apache Tribe and other federal land management agencies. Clay Crowder, assistant director for Arizona, successful free-ranging wild Mexican wolf population was impossible. But as we can see from the ninth consist, 124 wild Mexican wolves in Arizona, including 23 wolf packs, defined as a group of two or more wolves with an established range. There are slightly more in New Mexico, at least 164 individuals in 37 packs. Lilly also noted that the program was seeing success in efforts to introduce captive-born pups into wild dens for fostering in order to increase the genetic diversity of the wild wolf population. Around 350 Mexican gray wolves currently live in captivity in the U.S. and Mexico. Conservation advocates, however, have frequently criticized the management and recovery plan that guides the combined federal and state effort to restore the Mexican wolf population. One of its primary critiques is geographical. The Mexican Wolf Experimental Population Area, MWEPA, spans much of Arizona and New Mexico south of Interstate 40. When wolves have roamed outside the boundaries of MWEPA, officials have attempted to relocate them back to designated recovery area. Claire Musser, executive director of the Grand Canyon Wolf Recovery Project, said describing the current wolf population as free-ranging was misleading. Wolves like Hope, F2979, have shown us that Mexican gray wolves are capable of finding and thriving in suitable habitat beyond the artificial I-40 boundary, Musser wrote in an email. She was referring to a wolf that was observed living west of Flagstaff in the summer of 2024 before being found dead in November. Arizona Game and Fish has not yet released an official cause of death for Wolf F2979, but it considers the death to be human-caused illegal mortality. The Grand Canyon ecoregion and the Southern Rockies offer the space, prey, and ecological connectivity necessary for a true recovery, Musser said. If we continue to confine wolves to politically drawn lines, we're not following science. We are failing the species. Wolves must be allowed to disperse naturally to ensure a genetically viable and self-sustaining population. A coalition of conservation organizations sued the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over Mexican wolf management in 2022, alleging the agency has repeatedly failed to follow the best available scientific evidence regarding the measures needed to recover Mexican wolves. Among other criticisms, the conservation groups claim the current recovery plan does not do enough to ensure genetic diversity in the wild wolf population. The case is ongoing in the U.S. District Court of Arizona, and the latest oral arguments took place before Judge Scott R. Rash on the morning of Wednesday, March 5th. Craig Miller, the senior Arizona representative for the organization Defenders of Wildlife, one of the parties to the lawsuit, said the scientific and technical nature of the arguments made it a challenging case and praised the judge for making a concerted effort to understand the positions of both sides. Without stronger genetic management, the population faces long-term risks of reduced fitness, disease vulnerability, and lower survival rates, Miller said. He explained, "What we're asking for is that there be, rather than a metric that measures effort, there should be a metric that measures the actual health of the population, a genomic metric." The data necessary for such a measurement are already available, he noted. The field team collects blood samples regularly from both foster pups introduced to the wild population and wolves receiving medical checks. Although Defenders of Wildlife is engaged in a lawsuit over the Fish and Wildlife Service recovery rule, Miller said there is also concern about abrupt terminations of employees at the agency. Like the U.S. Forest Service and National Park Service, Fish and Wildlife has been affected by the sweeping job cuts the Elon Musk-led Department of Government Efficiency imposed upon federal agencies soon after President Donald Trump's inauguration. At least three Fish and Wildlife Service biologists on the Mexican wolf program have been fired, Miller noted. They've been doged. The firings came at a particularly bad time, he said, because the program is preparing for its annual effort to introduce captive-born pups, to wild dens for fostering. That work, Miller said, is crucial to the success of attaining the genetic health objectives of the wild population. Taking three experienced wolf technicians out of the program at the most vulnerable time of the year is not only harmful to the wolf population, it also will likely result in increased conflicts with livestock, he added. The fired biologists were responsible for monitoring wolf interactions with cattle and other livestock and using non-lethal means to prevent livestock predation. These three wildlife technicians spent several years volunteering prior to getting full-time career-bound positions, Miller said. To have the rug pulled out from under them with no heads up, it's just inhumane. He emphasized that the anticipated impacts of the Mexican gray wolf recovery program go beyond one species. As apex predators, Mexican wolves play a crucial role in maintaining the health of ecosystems by controlling prey like deer and elk, Miller said. This naturally regulates herbivory and prevents overgrazing, which allows vegetation to recover, supports biodiversity, and benefits numerous wildlife species and habitats. That balanced ecosystem leads to healthier, more resilient forests. It's not just about the wolves, he added. As a highly interactive species, restoring them to ecologically meaningful levels brings with it a whole suite of ecological benefits that complement and, in fact, sustain human communities. That article was Wolf Advocates Say Job Far From Done. You're listening to the Arizona Daily Sun program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Sun Sounds of Arizona has been bringing the disabled audio access to print information for over 45 years. To learn how you can support us, visit our website, sunsounds.org, where you can also listen to our live streams or find individual episodes on demand. You can also listen to us now through our dedicated app, which is available for free for both iPhone and Android devices at their respective app stores. Moving to the inside of the paper, we have a whole bunch of briefs on page 3, the first of which is Board of Supervisors Fill Final Opening on PNZ by Cody Bashore, with District 3 Supervisor Tammy Ontiveros nominating her replacement during Tuesday's Coconino County Board of Supervisors meeting. The county's Planning and Zoning Commission found its 10th and final member. Currently serving as a member of the Planning and Zoning Commission for the City of Williams, Larry Leslie was approved by the board to represent District 3 during Tuesday's meeting, during which Ontiveros detailed his qualifications for the role. After being elected to the board in November of 2024, Ontiveros departed the commission following a 14-year tenure, which included an extended stint as the commission chair. The vacancy in District 3 was the final opening after the appointments of David Hayward to represent District 1 and Tina Berger to represent District 2 in the past month. Additionally, multiple commissioners were shifted to new district districts as a result of the Coconino County's 2022 redistricting plan taking effect for 2025. Sat Best shifted to District 2 from District 1, while both District 2 commissioners John Ruggles and Rob Wilson moved to District 5. Following a 36-year career working for the same oil refinery that changed ownership from Union Oil to, eventually, Phillips 66, Leslie moved to Northern Arizona and later assisted the Williams City Council on improvements to its wastewater treatment plant. During his time with the oil refinery, according to Ontiveros, Leslie worked with a variety of government agencies, including the California Clean Coastal Waters, California Fish and Wildlife, and the Los Angeles County Sanitation District. I would like to thank you all for the opportunity to work on the Planning and Zoning Commission, Leslie said during the meeting. I look forward to a lot of learning and growing the community as well. Ontivero said Leslie's appointment brings the commission to a complete 10 members for the first time in her memory. Leslie's term is set to expire on February 25, 2029. Judge to retire, opening a new vacancy on Superior Court. Judge Elaine Fridlin Horn, who has served on the Coconino County Superior Court since her election in 2010, will retire on April 30th. The Coconino County Commission on Trial Court Appointments is now accepting applications to fill the vacancy that Fridlin Horn's retirement will create. And, oh, I should note that while that previous short was by Cody Bashor, the rest are just noted as Daily Sun staff. Fridlin Horn currently oversees Division 4 of the court, hearing cases on adoptions, minor dependency, domestic violence involving children, custody, and visitations. Applicants for the position must be at least 30 years of age, of good moral character, admitted to practice law in and a resident of Arizona for the past 5 years, and a resident of Coconino County for the past year. Anyone who submitted an application for the previous vacancy on the court, which Governor Katie Hobbs filled just last week, appointing Flagstaff attorney Neil Sherman to the bench, does not need to reapply to be considered for the new vacancy. The judicial application form is available on the Arizona Judicial Branch website at azcourts.gov/JNC. Applications are due by 3 p.m. March 31st. The Coconino County Commission on Trial Court Appointments will be responsible for reviewing applications, interviewing candidates, and recommending a slate of nominees to the governor. Dates and venues for the commission's future meetings have not yet been announced. As of March 1st, the county was seeking residents to serve on that commission and its associated nominating committees. County seeks residents to fill court commission vacancies. Coconino County is seeking community members for the Commission on Trial Court Appointments or to be part of the nominating committees. The two groups are the first steps in the merit selection process of appointing new Coconino County Superior Court judges. Each county supervisor has 3 seats from their respective districts on the commission. 2 are recommended by the nominating committee, and the 3rd is recommended by the Coconino County Bar Association. Before becoming a member of the commission, applicants are recommended by the nominating committee, appointed by the governor, and confirmed by the state senate. To apply for the commission, visit coconino.az.gov/3285/commission-on-trial-court-appointments. Again, coconino.az.gov/3285/commission-on-trial-court-appointments with hyphens in between each word. The 5-7-member nominating committees solicit, review, and recommend 2 nominees for the commission per district. If interested in serving, contact the county supervisor's office for the district where you reside. Applicants for the commission and nominating committees must be a 5-year state residency, a 1-year supervisor district resident, cannot be a judge, retired judge, or lawyer practicing before the state Supreme Court, and cannot hold governmental office, elected or appointed, for profit. Northern Arizona Orthopedics adds a new spinal surgery procedure. A spine surgeon with Northern Arizona Orthopedics, NAO, is offering a new spinal surgery procedure in Flagstaff. Orthopedic spine surgeon Dr. Fadi Hijji, spelled H-I-J-J-I, recently completed his third dual portal endoscopic spine surgery. According to NAO's announcement, the surgery uses 2 small incisions to target and decompress nerves in the spinal canal and is only offered by a handful of specialized medical centers in the U.S. Traditional surgery for compressed spines require larger incisions, it said, leading to muscle trauma and longer recovery times. Using an endoscopic camera is a lower impact approach meant to reduce post-operative pain and recovery time. Endoscopic spine surgery has the possibility to change the game for patients, Hijji said in a Thursday's announcement. The potential benefits are less pain, a faster recovery time, and fewer complications. He added, I'm excited to bring this technology to the people of Northern Arizona, and it's my hope that more patients will explore this option as a path to better spine health. Artist wanted for public sculpture at Spruce Watch Wedge. Spruce Wash Wedge. The city of Flagstaff is seeking artists for a new public art installation at the Spruce Wash Wedge, located at the corner of East Cedar Avenue and Northwest Street. The city's goal is to create a landmark 3-dimensional artwork and a distinctive icon, a press release stated. This is an exciting opportunity for an artist or artist team to design a striking sculpture for Flagstaff's East Side, said Jana Weldon, the city's Beautification Arts and Sciences Program Manager. The artist will join a design team with a supporting landscape architect to dynamically incorporate a 3-dimensional artwork at Spruce Wash Wedge, add visual interest to the urban environment, and contribute to the city's ongoing commitment to community-centered public art. Artists who are interested must submit a statement of qualifications detailing their experience and competence. Statements are due by 3 p.m. on March 25th, 2025. A selection panel will choose an artist to provide professional design services, and once the design is finalized and approved by the city, fabrication and installation. The guidelines for the artwork state that it should be site-specific, weather-resistant, low-maintenance, and safe. It is also expected to deter graffiti. The application and additional information are available at flagstaff.az.gov/441. And that concludes today's briefs. In regional news, Anna Eric, writing for Cronkite News, has this piece, Change Labs Offers Navajo Entrepreneurs Tools for Success. What started in 2013 as a once-a-year event to help Native American small business owners has grown into a launchpad for Navajo entrepreneurs. Based in Tuba City, the nonprofit Change Labs offers a modern workspace, classes in business strategies, coaching, and financing for Native entrepreneurs with a business idea. The program allows them to set up and grow their companies and in turn help their communities. Heather Fleming, co-founder and executive director of Change Labs, had a 20-year career as a product design consultant in Silicon Valley. She eventually started her own business in San Francisco, where she worked in the international development community with social entrepreneurs, mostly in East Africa and India. Through a mutual friend, she met Jessica Stego, who at the time was trying to develop an incubator for Navajo businesses. The women, both Diné, conceived of Change Labs as an event for Native entrepreneurs. Our first event was in Shiprock in 2013 at the Diné College Library. We didn't really expect anybody to come, but we had sold out our tiny little auditorium that holds about 80 people, Fleming said. It was good for us to see there were enough people interested in building a business community and saw the potential role entrepreneurs play in our own native economies. For 5 years, Fleming and Stago hosted events like the first one in Shiprock before realizing that their target market needed more help than once a year. There's a need for a presence in our communities 365 days out of the year, where people can access these conversations, resources, knowledge, and tools, Fleming said. When it came to developing brick-and-mortar infrastructure for Change Labs, Fleming and her colleagues decided to settle in Tuba City, the most populous community on the Navajo Nation. Although the plan took 2 years longer than they anticipated due to factors like cost increases during COVID-19, the organization has settled into a 1,400-square-foot work and event hub. The Tuba City eShip offers workspace where business owners can connect to Wi-Fi, use resources like a color printer, Cricut machine, and other tools to develop a marketing plan. Entrepreneurs can also book coaching appointments with the Change Lab team. So far, 69 owners have graduated from its business incubator, and 961 entrepreneurs have visited the eShip hub. Nearly 300 people attended coaching sessions, and 470 participated in workshops in 2024. Change Lab has funded 76 businesses and offered over $441,000 in business loans. Today, Native entrepreneurs like Daniel Tooley and Vanessa Tooley say they are grateful to have completed the business incubator program at Change Labs. Each of the siblings own their own businesses. Daniel Tooley owns Jinje Coffee and said he fell in love with coffee more than 10 years ago when he worked at Cartel Roasting in Phoenix. Since then, he started his own coffee business, running coffee pop-ups exclusively on the reservation. His relationship with Change Lab started when he worked as a designer for the organization, but he didn't get involved as a business owner until later, when one of the coaches from Change Labs, Tim Deal, approached him at a flea market in Tuba City. The way I got involved with Change Labs was being a designer and not really keeping up with what they did, he said. Now getting involved as a business owner, it's really cool to see two different sides of the way they run things. As a client of Change Labs, he joined the Kinship Lending Program, which focuses on building good financial foundations. With the help of the program, he was able to buy an espresso machine, roaster, and other equipment for his business. As a graduate, Tooley credits Change Labs for giving him the tools to build a business plan and now and into the future. You get what you put into the program, he said. You can just go through the motions of being a participant, but the only way you're going to succeed is if you really put the time into doing what they ask you to do. Vanessa Tooley, owner of Ahehe Shidine'e Home Care, also attributes much of her success to Change Labs. Owning and operating a home care business for the past 6 years without a college degree, she recognized there were business steps she was not aware of and was uncertain how to expand her company. I never had this guidance before. It was really great to have access to folks that specialize in these fields and professionals that know and have worked with other businesses and entrepreneurs, she said. It helped that the services were free. That's what I appreciated the most. All the funders that help with programs like Change Labs, I'm very grateful for them. After working with the nonprofit, her company has won the Phoenix Indian Center's Business of the Year for the American Indian Excellence in Leadership Award in 2024. Change Labs receives funding from a variety of places, including Wells Fargo Bank's Invest Native Initiative, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, Native Voices Rising, and the Federal Home Loan Bank of San Francisco. That was Change Labs Offers Navajo Entrepreneurs Tools for Success. Also from Cronkite News, by Alyssa Horton, Arizona's National Parks and Forests Already Feeling Strain from Federal Firings. Arizona national parks and forests are already feeling a strain on resources after President Donald Trump's executive order for a federal hiring freeze and extensive firings. Grand Canyon National Park, one of the state's 22 national park sites, reported wait times being twice as long as usual just a week after the National Park Service and National Forest Service fired hundreds. The park lost 4 toll operators, according to the Washington Post, despite being the second most visited park in the country. The Park Service fired an estimated 1,000 employees. The Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, has tried to slash numerous areas of federal funding, including for national parks and forests. A federal hiring freeze went into effect January 20th, but the Park Service has since been cleared to fill thousands of seasonal positions. While national parks are part of the Department of the Interior, national forests are part of the Department of Agriculture, which defended Trump's decision to cut positions. As part of this effort, USDA has made the difficult decision to release about 2,000 probationary non-firefighting employees from the Forest Service. To be clear, none of these individuals were operational firefighters, a USDA spokesperson wrote. It's unfortunate that the Biden administration hired thousands of people with no plan in place to pay them long term. Though USDA officials say 2,000 employees were let go, a union says the number is closer to 3,400 workers. Others have been less enthusiastic about the decision to release so many positions. Matthew Nelson, executive director of the Arizona Trail Association, said the decision is most likely to affect residents of the valley who travel around the state to access natural lands. Most of the public lands that we love and enjoy. So these are national forests, Bureau of Land Management lands, national parks. They're all managed by federal agencies, and right now those systems are being completely dismantled, Nelson said. In 2023, outdoor recreation added $14 billion to the Arizona GDP, according to the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. Beyond just the economic value of outdoor recreation, what it provides in terms of healthy living, I think it really, for me, defines what it means to be an Arizonan, Nelson said. That's why I live here, and why I've pursued the job and lifestyle I have here. If that were to ever change, it would completely transform how I see Arizona and America. Bill Wade, executive director of the Association of National Park Rangers, said, though the Valentine's Day massacre of firings wasn't a complete surprise, the extent wasn't anticipated. That's kind of using the broadsword rather than the scalpel, Wade said. Wade said those affected received an email at 4 p.m. February 14th and were given an hour and a half to return any government equipment. The National Park Service maintains it will continue hiring seasonal staff for better visitor experience. The National Park Service is hiring seasonal workers to continue enhancing the visitor experience as we embrace new opportunities for optimization and innovation in workforce management, a spokesperson wrote. We're focused on ensuring that every visitor has the chance to explore and connect with the incredible, iconic spaces of our national parks. In a social media post about the Grand Canyon, Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs said the Trump administration's removal of essential workers undermines our economy and ability to showcase one of the greatest natural wonders to the world. On Friday, Hobbs said despite the challenges at the Grand Canyon, she would not use state resources to aid the park, according to the Arizona Capital Times. Volunteers and employees of the Park Service around the state have said Arizonans and tourists will likely feel the fallout of fewer resources. When this workforce continues to be diminished, it'll also affect our ability to maintain trails, Nelson said. We also need our partners at the Forest Service and the BLM and the National Park Service to be engaged in that process. Otherwise, everything falls apart. That was Arizona's National Parks and Forests feeling strain from federal firings. And now, sports. NAU basketball eliminates Sacramento State in Big Sky Tournament, advances to semifinals, by Noah Butler in a special to the Daily Sun. The number 2-seeded Northern Arizona basketball team grinded out a second-round victory over the number 8-seeded Sacramento State Hornets on Sunday, 69-65, at the Big Sky Conference Tournament in Boise. The solid team defense, combined with late free throws from Northern Arizona guards Taylor Feldman and Leah Beatty, scored a 4-point win and a spot in the semifinals. Northern Arizona pulled down 59 rebounds, including 15 from forward Sophie Glancy. This tied with the most rebounds in the Big Sky Conference tournament by the Lumberjacks. Glancy also recorded 15 points, earning her 17th double-double of the season and 24th overall. The Lumberjacks shot 21 of 75 from the floor, including 6 of 30 from the three-point line. However, the 59 rebounds provided Northern Arizona with extra opportunities to put points on the board. The added physicality also allowed Lumberjacks to take 25 free throws, completing 21 of those attempts. Lumberjacks head coach Lori Payne emphasized the importance of free throws in the team's performance. "It'll win you games and it'll lose you games," Payne said. "I'm proud of the team for stepping up and knocking them down. They were really cool under pressure." Northern Arizona started the game with an early 17-7 run fueled by team play. 5 different players scored on this initial spurt, and the offense looked to be clicking for the Lumberjacks. However, Sacramento State's star guard, Benthy Versteeg, scored 2 tough baskets to get the Hornets back within striking distance as the quarter came to a close. Versteeg was a menace on the offensive end in the second frame, providing 2 assists and 5 points. She finished the contest with 24 points, 9 rebounds, and 5 assists. The Hornets closed the gap to 6 points, 34-28, after 20 minutes of play. NAU stayed afloat in the second period due to a late layup by Glancy to stave off the fervent Sacramento State run. The Lumberjacks' offense continued to falter into the third quarter, and eventually the opposition caught back up. Lumberjacks guard Taylor Feldman and Glancy tried to steer the offense in the right direction, but the free throws were few and far between and could not hold up the lead forever. As a result, a late three-pointer by Sacramento State forward Katie Peniuta tied the score at 46-46 going into the fourth quarter. She hit the first bucket of the final frame to give her squad its first lead since opening possession. Northern Arizona senior guards Naya and Olivia Moran made back-to-back shots to give the Lumberjacks the lead back and spark a feisty 7-0 run that put them back in control. When the run on offense tapered out, the Lumberjacks' defense stood strong and forced multiple turnovers. Feldman said she knew her team would not falter on defense, even after her team's distinct lack of offensive firepower. "We try not to let our offense dictate our defense, and our defense dictate our offense," Feldman said. "If we have bad possessions on offense, it means our defense has to be top tier, and vice versa." Northern Arizona will either play the number 3-seeded Idaho or number 6-seeded Montana on Tuesday, March 11th at 1:30 p.m., which means they've already played it by now, and we'll find out what the results are soon in probably next newspaper on Thursday. That was NAU Lumberjacks edge Hornets to advance to semifinals. Ask the vet. What to do if a pet ingests human medication? By Julianne Miller. Q. My brother came to visit, and my dog went to in his room and ate all his medication. What do I do? A. Discovering your dog has ingested a human medication can be a terrifying experience. Human medications are often toxic to dogs, and even seemingly harmless over-the-counter drugs can have severe consequences. Immediate action is crucial to minimize potential harm. The first and most important step is to contact your veterinarian or an animal poison control center immediately. They can provide expert guidance based on the specific medication, ingested dosage, and your dog's size and health. Do not wait for symptoms to appear, as some medications can cause delayed reactions. While waiting for professional advice, gather as much information as possible. Note the name of the medication, the dosage, the amount ingested, and the time of ingestion. This information will be invaluable to the veterinarian or poison control specialist. Do not attempt to induce vomiting without explicit instructions from a veterinarian or poison control center. Some medications can cause further damage if vomited back up. They can also provide guidance on whether activated charcoal, which can absorb certain toxins, might be beneficial. Monitor your dog closely for any signs of distress. These may include vomiting, diarrhea, lethargy, tremors, seizures, difficulty breathing, or changes in behavior. If any symptoms appear, transport your dog to the nearest emergency veterinary clinic immediately. Prevention is key to avoiding such situations. Keep all medications, including over-the-counter drugs and vitamins, securely stored in childproof containers and out of reach of your dog. Never leave medications unattended on countertops or tables. Be mindful of dropped pills and clean them up immediately. Educate yourself and your family about the potential dangers of human medication to pets. By taking these precautions and acting swiftly in case of accidental ingestion, you can help protect your dog from serious harm. And that was Ask the Vet by Dr. Julianne Miller, a Flagstaff veterinarian. She can be reached at drmiller@canyonpet.com. You've been listening to the Arizona Daily Sun program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. From Sun Sounds Flagstaff Studios, this is your reader, Bethany Williams. I hope you have a good evening. Stay tuned next for probably the Wall Street Journal, but maybe something else. Either way, it'll be good.